Tonight on Arena, Tom Moore and Ross Stewart on Wolfwalkers, the latest animation from Cartoon Saloon, and Helen Cullen asks, where do I begin with Richard Linklater? Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The animated feature Wolfwalkers was launched in Kilkenny last weekend by the locally based animators Cartoon Saloon. The film, which is set in Kilkenny in 1650, received rave reviews when it premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival, and it's now being tipped for an Academy Award. Nothing new to Cartoon Saloon, the idea that they might get an Academy Award. Joining me now, Tom Moore and Ross Stewart from Cartoon Saloon, the creators behind the latest offering, Wolfwalkers. We'll come back, Ross, to the whole idea of the possibility of an Academy Award shortly. But let's talk about Wolfwalkers, first of all, and its setting. It's seen this as the completion of a trilogy from The Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea. So where are we with Wolfwalkers?
Wolfwalkers is set in 1650, as you say, and it's the end of a trilogy of Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea, in that it's another film set around, you know, a kind of a shapeshifter folk tale myth legend. It takes place in Kilkenny, our city where we're actually based, and it's an action adventure with a deep environmental and social message.
I suppose the two young girls, because it's ever two young girls, kind of, and two half-wolf, possibly, in the case of one of the characters, Tom, they really are at the heart of this world that we're brought into, an English girl and an Irish girl. How significant is that?
Yeah, well, that's something that we wanted to do right from the beginning, to show that, you know, if the person who's hunting the wolf becomes a wolf, they'll see things from a very different point of view, and they'll be able to see things from another point of view. And then also the fact that a little English girl changes her entire worldview when she meets Maeve, and that they're able to be friends despite their differences. We thought that was something really important to put at the heart of the story, you know.
Yeah, so Maeve is the little Irish girl. How would you define her relationship with her wolf being?
It's actually based on this folklore from around here in Kilkenny called the Wolves of Ossory, and it's kind of like the wolf is a symbol of her wildness. It's a part of her, and it leaves her almost like an astral projection, and her body stays asleep back at home while the wolf kind of prowls the forest. And anything that happens to the wolf happens to her sleeping body back at home. So it's a bit different than your average werewolf story. And it was one of the more interesting takes on the kind of lycanthrope mythology that we found from around this area, you know.
And I wonder, Ross, to what extent are these wolves that we meet in Wolfwalkers, are they more benign creatures possibly than the werewolves that Tom has mentioned there?
Yeah, we wanted to steer clear of like the whole monster analogy. You know, like when we researched the folktales of old Ireland about wolves, we found that wolves weren't always seen as creatures to be feared. They actually sometimes were respected and helped people. You know, almost seemed like a symbiotic relationship, in that if they left the wolves alone, the wolves would leave them alone, you know?
Yeah, a little bit of message in there around how we treat the natural world, for sure. And maybe re-wolfing the woods of Kilkenny, perhaps. let's have a listen to a clip which features the two young girls. Honor Niefsi, I presume I don't say the K in Honor's name. She plays Robin. Robin Goodfellow, who's the little English girl, whereas Maeve is played by Eva Whittaker, who's the little Irish girl. And Robin stumbles upon Eve in her den, but a little bit of a friendship starts to build up between the two of them.
Stay here in the forest. It's great. Loads of running, playing, eating, messing, climbing. Free. I can't leave my father. He has to work for the Lord Protector. And Maeve, you can't stay in the forest either. They're cutting it all down.
No way. I scared them off.
The Lord Protector wants the wolves gone.
Dead.
You have to leave.
We were leaving. Me, Mammy, with the pack.
What stopped you?
Mammy went off.
As a wolf?
Yeah, to find us a new place to live. I'm sure it's some huge den with no stinkers around. And loads of food. It's going to be amazing.
So then, where is she? Do you think she got caught?
No, she's fine. Nobody can catch my mammy. And anyway, if she was caught by those stinkers, I'd get me wolves to eat them.
So, you're waiting for her to come back?
Yep. It's just her, me, and the whole world.
Like me and Father.
I dare you, or I presume there is nobody who is not smiling while listening to that clip from Wolf Walkers from Cartoon Saloon. Robin, the little English girl played by Anna Neefsey, and Maeve, the little Irish wolf girl played by Eva Whittaker, and Tom Moore and Ross Stewart of Cartoon Saloon, and the co-creators of Wolf Walkers, both speaking with me this evening. I'll ask you, Tom. Where do you find your young child actors? Those voices are so clear. You know exactly who the character is, and that's even without seeing the lovely animation.
I know, and it's so amazing. Like, we had Eva down, and, you know, it's already 3 or 4 years since we recorded her, and she was down in Kilkenny Animated this weekend. We had the kind of premiere screenings, and it was amazing meeting her again. You know, we met her a couple of times over the course of production, but when we first met her, I think she was 8 years old, so she was more or less barely born when we had the idea for the film, you know. And my whole career has been this lucky thing where I've managed to find young kids to play the parts of characters that were probably in my head long before they were even born. But Honor was fantastic. We had a great casting director, Louise Keeley. She got us loads of auditions from kids in England, and Honor just stood out. She was just obviously the right choice, and she was quite experienced young actor even then.
Louise Keeley was Normal People as well, wasn't she? She's casting all the great stuff at the moment.
Yeah, and then she found Eva as well, and Eva hadn't done anything before, but she was just embodied the character, and she had a lovely husky voice, and she was class. Yeah.
Now, Robin Goodfellow, from my large memory of Shakespeare, is a character in Midsummer Night's Dream. Puck is the character in Midsummer Night's Dream, can be played by either a male or female actor. We're in a world where the forest in Midsummer Night's Dream is a magical place, and the town or the city of Athens in that case is a really nasty place. That you have carried through to the story here in some ways, I think, Ross.
We drew from so many old legends and myths, and even the names like Robin Goodfellow. When we were researching old English names, they threw up some amazing names, you know, like there was such a rich well to draw from. There's definitely quite a few nods to old tales, and even the plot of Wolfwalkers, it's got its old kind of mythical legend type trope to it, you know.
But it also has, yes, it has that mythical legend aspect to it, but it quite definitely is a very Cromwellian and Puritanical Kilkenny that we're meeting as well, Ross.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating time of Irish history when Cromwell, you know, came over with his conquest. I mean, there was such a pitting of two societies against each other. With that conflict comes the great beginnings of any story, you know.
Getting that, the kind of the realism of that history, and that's reflected, I think, in the style of drawing, the difference between town and forest.
Oh yeah, like we tried to make the town look like woodblock prints from that time period, which at the time were kind of used as a kind of anti-Irish propaganda, and they were fairly quickly manufactured, so sometimes the colour would slip a little bit, and we even got that into the look of the town and the people in from the town, so they're quite geometric. And then complete contrast, we tried to make the forest really loose, look really sketchy, pencil-y, charcoal-y, watercolours, so that you've got a real contrast in the way that we draw both kind of worlds and both world views, I guess.
And if Louise Keeley did well at finding younger actors for you to play the characters of Robin and Maeve, she certainly did well in terms of some of the other names she put up forward for you as well. Bill is Robin's dad, or have I got
that's
that?
Right? Yeah.
Bill is Robin's dad, played by Sean Bean, and Sean Ogg is played by Tommy Tiernan. And Tommy isn't so happy, or Sean Ogg, I should say, isn't so happy about the soldiers getting rid of all the wolves in the forest. And the Lord Protector, Simon McBurney, also appears in the midst of this.
By God, you're one lucky girl. Did you not see? 'Twas a wolf walker, Bikram.
Now calm down, will you?
Everyone knows you can't be cutting down their woods. If you do, they'll get you. So that's the deal.
There's no deal with anyone.
St. Patrick made it with the old pagans, and you're breaking it, you Egypt!
We need to clear the woods.
Did you not see?
Actually, I did see the wolf attack.
The way them wolves answered her call. Them forests is riddled with wolves, I tell you.
Well, won't be long before the wolves are gone.
It won't be long before they're inside the town walls with the hunger.
No, no, we'll tame these lands. The Lord Protector has ordered it.
Ah, the great Lord Protector, renowned for being true to his word. Hilarious. At least the old king kept us safe. He's just an upstart. Lord Protector.
Lord Protector!
Protector of what?
Oi! Oi, come here!
If you have grievances, you should speak with me directly.
What are you doing? No! Get your hands up!
Hold still!
Jesus Christ! Let me out of here! I did nothing wrong!
Another wolf attack?
Aye, my lord.
A few more like him and we have another rebellion on our hands. If we do not clear the trees, the farmers cannot work the land, and the woodcutters cannot clear the trees with these wolves. This is not acceptable.
Aye, my lord.
We must show them the wolves are no threat. They're just beasts. Finish them.
Yes, my lord.
Simon McBurney there as the Lord Protector, Sean Bean as Bill, and the wonderful Tommy Tiernan as Sean Og in that scene from Wolfwalkers. Tom Moore, Ross Stewart of Cartoon Saloon speaking with me this evening. That touches, Ross, I think it begins to touch on, there is an ecological theme, and this has run through, I suppose, The Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea as well, our relationship with the natural world and how important it is to get that balance right. That I think has been important through all three films, hasn't it?
Definitely, and it's something that Tom and myself, you know, care very deeply about, and it's something that at the start of Wolfwalkers we thought might be better in this age, but it actually seems to be worse. You know, it's very prescient at the time. Our balance with the natural world seems to be tipping, you know, ever worse as the years go by. We didn't want to be preachy in this. It's just positing a proposition, you know, that like as the town keeps on expanding into the forest, the wolves have no place to live, so they end up attacking, you know.
And I think, Tom, you also have a Greenpeace short. Is that actually will that be as part of this as well, as part of this feature? Tell me a bit about that short.
Well, we're doing a short in conjunction with Greenpeace. We're just finished it, and we're hoping it'll go play with Wolfwalkers. And it's targeting talking about the Amazon, the destruction of the Amazon for industrial meat production, and trying to get people to pay attention to that and maybe boycott companies that are allowing for that kind of destruction. Because obviously, the woods in Ireland all got burnt down and used for ships and stuff, but the Amazon is our lungs, and we have to try and protect it. It's still there, or most of it's still there. So that's what we're trying to raise awareness around. There's actually parallel between the story, unfortunately, of what happens in Wolfwalkers and the Greenpeace short, which is about a jaguar in the Amazon trying to convince a little boy to think about the choices he makes in his kitchen that might be affecting animals in the Amazon.
I wondered too, Ross, to what extent wolf vision, which I've heard lots about in conjunction with this film, where we're inside or we get the point of view of the wolf, him or herself. Was that you empowering and giving power back to those natural beings?
Well, we always kind of thought that, you know, if you step inside the shoes of your enemy, you get a chance to see their point of view, and suddenly, you know, you have to have a bit of empathy towards them. So we were always thinking from the very start that if a hunter was able to, you know, step inside the shoes of his prey, see the world through the eyes of the prey, then, you know, maybe their point of view might change. You know, there's definitely a thing between hunter and the hunted, but even in worldviews, like the people that we're told to be afraid of or fear or that are our enemy, if you have to live a day in their shoes, you might not see the world the same way.
I was interested, Tom, to see, this is the first animated feature that's been co-produced by Apple. I was interested to hear some of the words, one particular very Irish word that they would not allow you use in the film.
Oh, feck. We had it in Song of the Sea and we couldn't squeak it by in Wolfwalkers. But other than that, they weren't too bad, you know. Yeah. They were pretty hands-off.
One final thing, actually. I know you've both spoken about this. Maybe I'll ask you it, Ross. That 101 Dalmatians, given that there's dogs involved there, or canines, I suppose, I should say, to be more correct, that had an influence on the style of how you did Wolfwalkers. Just to expand that a little bit for me.
there was kind of a golden era of animation, you know, back in the 70s and early 80s, and 101 Dalmatians has this beautiful watercolor style, you know, where the lines are a little bit offset, and that was a huge influence on the backgrounds. But we drew influences from so many, many different directions and different parts of art, like high art and visual art. So 101 Dalmatians was one of our favorites, but by no means the only one.
Yeah, okay. Just one final thing. I mentioned the Academy Awards at the very beginning. I think is it you, Tom, that has the two Academy nominations? Is it going to be third time lucky? I know that Cartoons Lounge, everything they do gets an Academy nomination.
Now, you wouldn't want to get blasé about it, but I have to say, Kilkenny have gotten massively behind it now. We're doing the whole Wolfwalkers month. We have an exhibition in Butler Gallery. I mean, we make these films for the audience, not for Academy members. So if all the people in Kilkenny go and see all the events that we've lined up for Wolfwalkers Month, I'll be happy. And then anything like an award nomination would be a bonus on top of that.
Icing on cake, but you want the cake first, that's for sure. Listen, lovely to speak with you both, and really looking forward to getting to see the film in its entirety and properly. That's Tom Moore and Ross Stewart talking to me there about Wolfwalkers. To mark the release of Wolfwalkers, the month of October, as Tom was just telling us there, will be dedicated to the film with a series of outdoor events in Kilkenny. And the film is due to have its cinema release on October the 30th. I presume that all dependent on restrictions being lifted, etc., etc. But it will be then on Apple TV in December. You said, "Tell me there," from Derry singer Riva. And Riva is one of 50 artists whose performances were filmed recently at venues across Dublin. They'll be made available to ticket holders as part of Ireland Music Week, which runs from today, October the 6th, through until Friday, October the 9th. And all of the artists, young and upcoming, new and emerging Irish talent. And this is a way of introducing them to us. The week will also feature 49 workshops, which may be of interest to those who want to enter the music business. You can find out full details on IrelandMusicWeek.com. Richard Linklater is an award-winning Texan film director, producer and screenwriter best known for his loosely structured, talkative indie films that often deal with the subjects of suburbia, dreaming and the passage of time. 31 films in total he has directed, been nominated for 5 Academy Awards, most recently in 2015, where he was nominated for Best Director, Best Original Screenplay and Best Film. And that was all for Boyhood. But he has given us indie love stories, animated movies and blockbusters, so has a daunting back catalogue. So here to answer our frequently Tuesday night question, where do I begin with, is author Helen Cullen. So before we get into the films themselves, Helen, maybe tell us a little bit about Richard Linklater himself and what kick-started his career. Kind of an extraordinary story in the way he got going, really.
It is extraordinary. Hi, Sean. It's so nice to talk to you this evening. Well, Richard, as you mentioned, is American, and he was born in Houston, Texas in 1960. And I guess his adolescence, he didn't really fit in with what we might imagine is kind of the high school stereotype, because he had this kind of weird hybrid identity where he played baseball and football and was the quarterback for the number one team in Texas. But also when he was in high school, he won the Scholastic Art and Writing Award, which identified students with remarkable creative talent and really showcased their work on a national level. So it was quite an interesting that he had, you know, feet in both camps when he was in high school. And then after he left school, he dropped out of college and went to work on an oil rig for 2 years off the Gulf of Mexico, which is, you know, a remarkable
what
thing,
a journey,
next
you
move
know?
For him. But apparently what kept him going when he was out in the oil rig was just reading obsessively. And he became completely obsessed with storytelling and narrative structure and really thinking about, you know, the novels that he was reading and what made them work the way they did. And when he went back on dry land, then he got involved in the theatre scene in Texas and decided he wanted to be a filmmaker. So he took that money he'd saved up while working on the oil rig and bought a Super 8 camera, which seems to be where all of these directors begin, you know, with their hands on a Super 8 camera, and enrolled in the Austin Community College and started studying film when he was 24.
And
so that's where it all began.
It's what he did with a film called Slacker that really catapulted him into the big time, but certainly got him noticed.
Absolutely. So after only 2 years of him being in film school, he made one feature film, which is such a poignant title when we know about his time on the Isle of Rig, called It's Impossible to Learn to Plough by Reading Books. And that kind of gave him his first practice at putting a feature film together. But then he set up his own development company and made the film you mentioned, Slacker, for only $23,000, which is virtually nothing in terms of film production budgets. But it went on to gross $1.25 million. And of course, that was his career kickstarted. And it kind of laid the foundations for him becoming this indie film cult icon, you know, that's so celebrated today.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the major celebrating point of that is an early film, Before Sunrise, which is part of a trilogy, which we'll come to in a minute. 1995, that was released in. Now, you weren't watching it in 1995, I don't think, Helen.
Well, I was 14 when Before Sunrise was released. So in some ways, I was kind of primed for the kind of captive audience that was going to fall in love with this really romantic film. But I mean, I would have seen it a little bit later than when it was first released by the time it came across the pond to us. I remember watching it on a VHS videotape in my friend's house. I felt like I'd never seen anything like it before. And I haven't seen much like it since. I mean, it's 25 years on, but it still feels really fresh. And the only thing that really ages it is the fact that no one has any smartphones and they're not using Google Maps to get around. But it could be really now.
Yeah, and remind us of the setup in Before Sunrise, because in some ways it's incredibly simple, but the story that unfolds is beautifully complex.
Oh, it's incredibly simple in its premise. So we have this young couple, Jesse, an American kind of puppy dog dreamer sort of character played by Ethan Hawke, and Celine, who's this sophisticated French intellectual played by Julie Delpy. And they meet on a train and strike up a conversation and realise that they have this connection that results in them disembarking together to spend just one night in Vienna before Jesse flies back to America. So the film is essentially just the two of them walking through the city, maybe falling in love with each other, talking about life and the universe and being open with each other in a way that maybe you only can be when you're, you know, 20 and in a European city, and believe that it's a completely rational thing to do to jump off a train and spend the night walking around.
Well,
the stranger.
Let's have a listen to how it is that Jesse and Celine come to believe that it could be a rational thing just to jump off the train and go off for the day together, or the night together, in fact. And it is, as you mentioned, the two actors gone out of my head now.
Say that
Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. Thank you very much. And here they are at the moment of disembarking the train, or deciding to do so.
All right, I have an admittedly insane idea, but if I don't ask you this, it's just, you know, it's going to haunt me the rest of my life.
What?
I want to keep talking to you. You know, I have no idea what your situation is, but I feel like we have some kind of connection, right?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right. Well, great. So listen, here's the deal. This is what we should do. You should get off the train with me here in Vienna and come check out the town.
What?
Come on, it'll be fun.
What would we do?
I don't know. All I know is I have to catch an Austrian Airlines flight tomorrow morning at 9:30, and I don't really have enough money for a hotel, so I was just going to walk around. And it'd be a lot more fun if you came with me. And if I turn out to be some kind of psycho, you know, you just get on the next train. All right. Think of it like this. Jump ahead 10, 20 years, okay? And you're married. And only your marriage doesn't have that same energy that it used to have. You know, you start to blame your husband. You start to think about all those guys you've met in your life and what might have happened if you picked up with one of them, right? Well, I'm one of those guys. That's me. You know, so think of this as time travel from then to now. To find out what you're missing out on. See, what this really could be is a gigantic favor to both you and your future husband to find out that you're not missing out on anything. I'm just as big a loser as he is, totally unmotivated, totally boring, and you made the right choice and you're really happy.
Let me get my bag.
Good woman yourself. That's Julie Delpy as Celine and Ethan Hawke. as Jesse in that. It's an iconic scene, really, isn't it, from Before Sunrise, where he persuades her to get off the train. Does Linklater manage, I suppose it's down to Ethan Hawke as well, does he manage to do that in a way that we're not uncomfortable? You know, it could be you kind of might say to the Julie Delphi's character, are you sure you want to head off with the guy you've just been talking to on the train for a few hours?
Well, I think that you've really hit on what's so interesting about these films, because, you know, if you watch them when you're at the same age as the characters, this seems just like the most thrilling, exciting thing that could ever happen, that you'd meet this handsome, you know, American stranger on a train and decide to spend an evening in Vienna. But then as we look back on it with the distance of time, and by the time the second movie came in Before Sunset, 9 years later in the trilogy, and then 9 years later again, you look back
Before
on this
midnight.
And realise that exactly, that there's only a very brief moment of time in your life when this seems like a brilliant thing to do, and it's full of kind of the romantic possibility that comes with youth. And I think that's part of the charm of these movies, that we get to look at the kind of evolution of how we feel about romance and adventure with the two characters of Celine and Jesse as they age and kind of change their perspective on it too over the course of the trilogy.
Do either of the other two, Before Sunset in 2004 from 2004, as you said, or Before Midnight from 2013, do either of them live up to the brilliance, I guess, of Before Sunrise?
They absolutely do. What's remarkable about them is that you would think that if you were going to try and imagine what might happen when we put these two characters together 9 years later in Before Sunset, and then 9 years later again in Before Midnight, that we might be able to anticipate what Richard Linklater would do, but they actually feel just as kind of spontaneous and unpredictable and miraculous as they did in that first movie, because, you know, Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy have aged, and the characters have aged, and their perspective on life has changed. And so when we reconnect with them, it equally feels just as an authentic encounter as it did when they met when they were their much younger selves. And I think that's a huge part to do with the way that Linklater writes these scripts and the way he directs them, that they feel completely spontaneous when you're watching them. It's hard to believe that they could possibly be scripted, and yet every single word is meticulously chosen.
Yeah, that's good acting as well, isn't it?
It's one of the remarkable
things. Yeah,
absolutely.
They make it sound as if they're making it up, but of course they're not.
The whole thing feels, and even just the kind of rhythm and pace of the way they talk to each other, they're sometimes stumbling over their words and they're sometimes not speaking at all. And there's this incredible scene where they're in a record store in Before Sunrise and they squeeze into a little listening booth to hear a track. And we just watch them in silence reacting to the music playing. And I think it's one of the best scenes in film that I've ever seen. But Linklater later on said that he didn't let them hear the song before they started shooting, so, you know, their reaction is so authentic to hearing this kind of song between them in that moment. It's amazing.
Yeah, they really had to listen.
Okay,
exactly. So and obviously the two of them, Delphi and Ethan Hawke, both involved in those three films, but Ethan Hawke in particular has a long relationship, creative relationship with Linklater.
He does. I think that, in fact, their creative collaboration became hugely important to them both as their careers developed from that early relationship that they established with the first film in the trilogy. They have remarkably similar backgrounds. Both of them are Texan. They were both raised in single-parent families. Even their fathers had the same jobs working in insurance companies. And they both had that love of both sports and the arts that was kind of a unique blend. So I think when they met each other, they were creative soulmates, really, and they went on to make another 8 films together. And Ethan Hawke really credits Linklater with being the person who pushed him the most in his craft, and all the big breakthroughs that he had in terms of his acting performances came as a consequence of the trust he had in the process that he went through when he was in these films with Richard.
So even though you've chosen Before Sunrise as our starting point, you are saying go on to the other two, and you're probably saying as part of this you could go on to make it into a fourth film in Walking Life, because there's a link between Walking Life and the Before trilogy.
There is. And what was really fascinating was, of course, when we watched Before Sunrise in 2005, in 1995, we had no idea, of course, that there were ever going to be the second film and the third film. So when Richard made this philosophical, strange animated film,
Waking Life.
Yeah, we had no idea that, you know, this that there was ever going to be any more of Celine and Jesse. But in this movie, where an unnamed man wanders through a series of dream-like realities where he meets different characters discussing these major existential issues, one of the couples he encounters are Jesse and Celine. So for fans of Richard Linklater, it was such an exciting thing to see them on screen again. But the film is animated. It was entirely rotoscoped, which means they basically shot it in digital video of live actors acting out the scenes, and then artists drew over those scenes to make it look animated. He uses that technique a few times, and famously also in a Scanner Darkly, which was what he made with Keanu Reeves, adapted from the Philip K. Dick novel. But it was really an incredible thing to see Celine and Jesse pop up again when we had no idea that we were ever going to have these extended adventures with them in the years to come.
Well, let's listen to them talking to each other once again. They're laying in bed, I think, at this point, aren't they?
Indeed.
Yeah, let's have a listen.
I heard that Tim Leary said, as he was dying, that he was looking forward to the moment when his body was dead, but his brain was still alive. You know how they say that there's still 6 to 12 minutes of brain activity after everything else is shut down? And the second of dream consciousness, right? Well, that's infinitely longer than a waking second. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, definitely. For example, I wake up and it's 10, 12, and then I go back to sleep and I have those long, intricate, beautiful dreams that seem to last for hours, and then I wake up and it's 10, 13.
Yeah, exactly. So then 6 to 12 minutes, right, of brain activity. I mean, that could be your whole life.
Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy once again in Richard Linklater's, this time Waking Life, the film that we see them in there. And that is the second choice of Helen Cullen in where you can begin with the works of Richard Linklater. But you're actually, for your next choice, Helen, bringing us back before the before trilogy, sorry, I'm mixing myself up here. You're bringing us to 1990 and the coming of age comedy Dazed and Confused.
Yes, so Dazed and Confused is the perennially popular 70 set coming-of-age comedy that gave Matthew McConaughey his big break. And it also features early career Ben Affleck. And it sort of offers an insight into a different side of Richard Linklater, which is his kind of obsession with the black comedy of suburbia and, you know, the beauty of the everyday. And so it's 1978, the last day of high school, and the seniors are preparing for their annual tradition of hazing the new freshmen coming into the school. And Richards has said about the movie that he felt that the 70s actually really sucked, but have become, you know, have this kind of romantic place in mythology in our minds now of what the decade was like. And he wanted to make an anti-nostalgia film that showed the reality of what it was like to be a teenager in the 70s, where he said all the other things he'd watched, there was too much drama, too much excitement. And really, the 70s, there were just teenagers hanging around waiting for something to happen, and nothing ever did. So that was his starting point for Dazed and Confused. But he said just by the very act of depicting it on screen, he also made it seem impossibly glamorous and exciting, that it's unavoidable.
And how would you describe the McConaughey character in this film?
Gosh, well, I mean, he's an acquired taste, definitely. He's very much, you know, the sort of classic kind of womanizing, girl skirt chasing, you know, jock of American high schools. But I suppose the thing about what Richard Linklater does is that he has such a kind of keen eye, almost like an anthropologist's eye for observing society, that even though it's spectacularly funny sometimes how he's, you know, really observing these rites of stupidity that the teenagers are going through, it's really artistic in the sense that he really plummets what it really means to be kind of an American suburbia at the time.
I like that phrase, rites of stupidity. And in the midst of the clip we're about to hear from Dazed and Confused, McConaughey uses what became a kind of a catchphrase, certainly for this character.
All right.
Oh, Christ.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Cool. You heard about the party being busted, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Not to worry. There's a new fiesta in the making as we speak. It's out at the Moon Tower. Full kegs. Everybody's gonna be there. You ought to go.
Okay.
Okay, we'll be there.
Okay.
Say you need a ride?
No, I got my own car. Thanks.
Yeah, well, listen, you ought to ditch the two geeks you're in the car with now and get in with us, but that's all right. We'll worry about that later. I will see you there, all right?
Bye.
I love those redheads, man.
I know you.
We had geography together, remember?
Oh, where's your pitch man?
He's really creepy, isn't he, Matthew McConaughey's character there, Helen Cullen?
He is. He's quite sleazy, quite creepy, but it's actually kind of remarkable.
He's a lot older than the other characters in the scene there.
Yeah, there's a famous joke that unfortunately people make and still think it's funny, where they say that they're getting older, but the girls stay the same age, the high school girls. And that's where it comes from. It's a famous Matthew McConaughey line from this film that has kind of filtered over into kind of just general parlance.
And you say if you like Dazed and Confused, 1995 Suburbia would be a good place to go after that. But let me bring you to your final choice in Where Do I Begin with Richard Linklater. We talked about the Before trilogy and that shot over a long period of time. Boyhood, it takes the biscuit when it comes to being shot over a long period of time. 3 Academy Award nominations and a Golden Globe win in 2015. What is the story he's telling here?
Well, as you say, it was shot over such a long period of time, quite unlike anything else that I know about, but 12 years of filming. So it really is a masterpiece where just the passing of time in an ordinary family is what constitutes as the plot. And we begin with a 6-year-old boy, Mason Jr., played by Eller Coltran, and then we watch him evolve from there to the 18-year-old he becomes at the end of the film. So they shot a little sequence every year for 12 years. His older sister, Samantha, is actually played by Richard Linklater's daughter, Lorelai, and his mum, Olivia, is played by Patricia Arquette. And then, of course, Ethan Hawke is back to play his dad. So it's quite remarkable, because we talk about coming-of-age films, but in this one, we actually see it unfolding before our eyes, this little boy growing up into a young man.
Is this an autobiographical tale, or is it totally fictional, do you think?
Well, I think the script was heavily inspired by both Richard Linklater's past and Ethan Hawke's, in terms of them both having been children of divorce. And Ethan Hawke said in particular that it helped him really sort of stumble upon his father's emotional truth, that as a child of divorce, he'd only really witnessed it from the perspective of being the little boy himself, maybe resenting his father for not being there for him. But then after he got divorced, he was able to see things from a new perspective and kind of an understanding for the pain that his father had gone through. So he said that Richard Linklater and themselves really ripped scenes, father-son scenes, directly from their own life and put them into the film. And I think it really sort of profoundly captures that obsession of Richard Linklater's of time and memory and, how we construct the narrative of our own lives. And it's just quite a remarkable thing to have taken on the artistic vision to think, I'm going to start this and let it run for over a decade. It's just remarkable.
This clip features Ethan Hawke as Mason Sr. and he's trying to get his kids to talk to him from Boyhood.
What you been up to?
Not much.
No? You still hanging with that kid, Joe?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's still your best friend?
Yeah, I guess.
What about you? How was your week?
Fine.
What you been up to?
Nothing really.
You still working on that sculpture project?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Almost finished.
What's it up?
Nothing.
All right. No. No, that is not how we are going to talk to one another, all right? No, I will not be that guy. You cannot put me in that category, all right? The biological father I spend every other week with and I make polite conversation, while he drives me places and buys me shit. No. Talk to me. Samantha, how was your week? I don't know, Dad, it was kind of tough. Billy and Ellen broke up, and Ellen's kind of mad at me because she saw me talking to Billy in the cafeteria. And you remember that sculpture I was working on? Well, it was a unicorn, and the horn broke off, so now it's a zebra, okay? But I still think I'm going to get an A, right? Mason, how was your week? Well, Dad, it was kind of tough. Joe, he's kind of a jerk. Actually, he stole some cigarettes from his mom. He wanted me to smoke them. But I said no, because I knew what a hard time you had quitting smoking, Dad. How about that? Is that so hard?
Dad, these questions are kind of hard to answer.
What is so hard to answer about what sculpture are you making?
It's abstract.
Okay, that's good. See, I didn't know that. I didn't know you were even interested in abstract art.
I'm not. They make us do it. But, Dad, why is it all on us, though? What about you? How was your week? Who do you hang out with? Do you have a girlfriend? What have you been up to?
I see your point.
That'll teach you to go asking your kids to speak to you. Ethan Hawke as Mason Senior there in a scene from Boyhood, and Helen Cullen has been answering or asking the question, where do I start or where do I begin with Richard Linklater? You want to give a couple of honourable mentions to some documentaries that he made as well that you think are about him rather, that you think are worth looking at, Helen?
Well, in terms of just really helping people kind of, as you say, to deal with this daunting back catalogue, in 2014 he made a documentary called 21 Years that reflected on 21 years of his filmmaking, and it kind of takes you on a behind the scenes tour and interviews lots of the actors and kind of collaborators that he's worked with throughout his career, and they give this amazing insight into what it's like to work with him as a director. And then in 2016, Dream is Destiny is a documentary that was made by one of the founders of the South by Southwest Festival, and they really just look at the impact he's had on the industry in a macro way, and how it kind of inspired this kind of low budget backyard movement in American films that, you know, has kind of endured. So I think they're a good way to get an overview of the whole canon of his work.
I thought you were going to tell me for a minute that it took him 21 years to make 21 years that he started.
No, but amazingly, he has one of his projects that he started now is a film that he's going to spend 21 years making, which is an adaptation of Merrily We Roll Along, the Stephen Sondheim musical. So that's incredible. So we can look forward to that in 17 or 18 years' time.
Well, let's be optimistic that we will sit and talk about it then, Helen. That's Helen Cullen talking to me about the movies of Richard Linklater, and Helen's second novel, The Truth Must Dazzle Gradually, is out now, published by Penguin Random House. Samuel Beckett's play Happy Days has been named one of the 40 best plays of all time. When we meet the central character Winnie, she's buried up to her waist, but regardless of discomfort, she follows her daily routine and prattles along to her husband Willie, who remains silent. As if that wasn't bad enough, in the second act, she's buried up to her neck, but valiantly she struggles on. So, has Happy Days something to say to us today, caught as we are in pandemic? Are we talking about level 3 and level 5 of being buried? That's exactly the question, I suppose, posed by Sligo's Blue Raincoat Theatre Company to celebrate their 30th year in existence, and who plan the production to go on as soon as it is possible, given restrictions, etc. And that will happen at the Sahan Factory in Hazelwood, just outside Sligo. Winnie and Willie, or should I say the actors portraying them, Sandra O'Malley and John Carthy, both regular Blue Raincoat performers, and they join me on the line now. She's quite a daunting character, Sandra, to have to take on. I mean, she carries the play really and truly.
This is true. How you doing, Sean? Thanks for having us on. But she's a very live, spontaneous woman, if you like. She's able to sort of deal with what's bubbling, if you like, beneath the surface. She gets on with stuff. She tries to sort of look at the positive side of things when things falter or they slightly break for her. She may get lost, but she will move on. She'll find something else to grasp on to keep her going, if you like, you know.
Given that she's buried up to her waist in Act 1 and up to her neck in Act 2 in this mound, what are the tools that she uses to hold us as audience members?
Well, I guess she's got all her little bits and bobs in her bag, you know. So she, when she goes through a routine, she kind of goes through that the daily ablutions, if you like. She brushes her teeth and da 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 da. That keeps her going for a little bit. She is an expressive being. She's got her arms at that point. She's got her words. They have not yet run out, you know, and. She's got her own sense of being an eccentric, I suppose, in a way, and also she entertains herself. And even if Willie isn't responding to her, she can come up with her little stories and all that. So she's well equipped, if you like, with all her own personal little tools.
I'm wondering, I suppose, specifically about the nature of the language that Beckett actually gives to her, because at one level, it's quite mundane. The things that she's doing are quite mundane. But she kind of speaks in quite a highfalutin way in many ways, and little snippets almost of quotes from big works and from Shakespeare's plays.
That's
and
right.
Things like that.
Yes, indeed. She she's not stuck for words.
No.
Winnie has her words, you know, and she's a little, she can rant and rave and she can babble and gabble and she can speak really quickly and she can do all of these things. And as I said, she comes up with their little stories to entertain her as well. And as you say, it's kind of an everyday language. But what's kind of powerful with Winnie is the way in which her mind works. So she can make ordinary things like just looking at the name on a toothbrush. That can become something else. It has a different value, you know? Yeah.
Well, let's listen to a clip. Yourself, obviously, involved here, Sandra, as Winnie, and running through a series of rituals to get her day started. And at this point, she's wondering, what about me hair? Have I brushed that yet?
My hair? Did I brush and comb my hair? I may have done. Normally I do. There is so little one can do. One does it all. All one can. 'Tis only human. Human nature, human weakness, natural weakness. I see no comb, nor any hairbrush. The comb is here, the brush is here. Perhaps I put them back after use, but normally I do not put things back after use. No, I leave them lying about and put them back all together at the end of the day, to speak in the old style, the sweet old style. And yet I seem to remember... Oh, well, what does it matter? That is what I always say. I shall simply brush and comb them later on. Purely and simply, I have the whole... them? Or it? Brush and comb it? Sounds improper somehow. What would you say, Willie? What would you say, Willie, speaking of your hair? Them? Or it? The hair on your head, I mean. The hair on your head, Willie. What would you say, speaking of the hair on your head? Them? Or it?
And that's Sandra O'Malley as Winnie in Samuel Beckett's Happy Days Blue Raincoat Theatre Company in Sligo, hoping to give us a production of that in the coming days and weeks. Just before I talk to John Carthy, who plays the character of Willie, who doesn't have quite the same amount to say as you do, it has to be said, Sandra. But just before I move on to John, I mean, had you seen it's a part that people like Rosine Linehan have played, Fiona Shaw, Back in Time, Billy Whitelaw, you know, this is a big part for a female actor to take on. Had you seen performances that you thought, ooh, don't know, is it daunting to take it on, having seen others do it?
Sean, I haven't actually.
Is that a good thing?
Well, put it this way, I was fresh. although I've done a couple of Becketts, but I was fresh to the idea of Winnie. Always had the dream of doing Winnie, as I think many actors do, you know. So, but coming into it in the middle of sort of lockdown, sort of knuckling down, if you like, to the lines, etc. That it was a very new experience for me. So I sort of came at it without any influence whatsoever. So we'll see where that leads us.
Where that brings us. So to you, John Carthy. And he doesn't really, Willie has very little to say and do in this play. So you're listening to it. I suppose that's really what this part is about. Does it strike you as you've listened to it in the situation we find ourselves in at the moment, obviously, in terms of lockdowns and different levels of lockdowns? Have you seen and noticed parallels that perhaps you hadn't noticed before?
A couple, yeah. I suppose one quote that comes to mind is Winnie has this repeating motif of, that is what I find so wonderful about things in life in general. But what she says, that is what I find so wonderful, the way man adapts himself to changing conditions. And in many ways, that's what we have to do, I suppose, given the situations that we're in at the moment, and adapt and go on with as much fearlessness as possible.
Yeah, and I mean, it really strikes me that change from Act 1 to Act 2, you know, it does mirror in many ways the different levels of lockdown that we may have to deal with in the coming weeks. There's a touch of that, isn't there?
There is indeed. And see how well we can handle it. And Winnie handles it admirably, you know, and hopefully we can as well too, you know. It's not an easy situation to be in, this kind of uncertainty.
30 years, John, between yourself and Niall Henry since the founding of Blue Raincoat. Now, you've adapted to many circumstances over those 30 years. When you look back at what the ideas that yourself and Niall had in the setting up of Blue Raincoat back three decades ago, what were they and how have they developed and changed over the years?
Oh, I suppose they've developed considerably, I suppose, with us growing up and growing out.
Physical theatre was always at the heart of it, though, wasn't it?
It was, but not in the early stages, because nobody in the company was versed enough or capable enough to actually implement any sort of physical theatre to any great extent. And it's only when we started training and started going over to Corinne Soom in London. A couple of us went over for 3 months of every year for about 3 years, and Sandra went over for a whole 3 years and trained there, and Fiona did, and Kevin Collins did. And so the company developed in that way through our training, and we'd come back and we'd implement the training we had in our bodies and in our minds, I suppose, and try to put that into play. And of course, Malcolm was writing Malcolm Hamilton, who formed the company with Niall, he was writing as well too, and so his plays then fed into that growth.
Yeah. And for you as an actor to be able to actually live, because I knew you at the time, you were in Dublin for part of it, and then you relocated to Sligo.
I bailed out just at that time.
But to be able to do that in your hometown must have been very gratifying.
It was. My parents were quite upset when I came back after paying so much good money to get me out of the place. But it was. But I knew Niall growing up. And the two of us knew each other. We went to kind of little drama school when we were 9 and 10 years of age, and we had formed a couple of plays together when we were in our teenage years. And he went away and trained in Marceau School, and I went to train in Trinity. And he came back and formed the company with Niall, and he was looking for somebody basically to form a company with.
And that brought me into the picture.
Yeah.
Here we are 3 decades later. Just one final quick question, Sandra. We're on level three now, the whole country on level three. Will that affect the venue or not? The factory is quite a big venue, isn't it?
Well, to be honest, Sean, we are not going to play in the factory. We have been lucky enough to be given a place called the Sahan Warehouse. It's actually...
All right, so this is a different so than we've the got usual a,
we've,
spot.
Indeed. Yeah. We've, got, right. we've got a massive venue, and we played Beckett out there before, so we won't have an issue. And the brilliant thing about it, despite how big the particular room will be doing Happy Days, and the acoustics are amazing, so it'll be very comfortable for the audience when hopefully, you know, in November sometime that we get to actually put it up.
Well, hopefully it will happen and the restrictions will lift sufficiently for that to happen, but it sounds like you've plenty of space in the Sahan factory to do so. Sandra O'Malley and John Carty there, happy birthday to Blue Raincoat, and Happy Days will be on next week in some fashion, hopefully again in November, and you can find out full details of exactly how it's all going to happen on blueraincoat.com. That's our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy, Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Ciarán Cullen was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.